you know, when I was growing up, my mom threatened to really stop buying me things because I would just take everything apart. So at 12, she bought me my first computer. And instead of getting on the internet, like most kids would do, I took it apart. She walked into my room and there was pieces everywhere. But I also built my first computer at 12 because it was, you will put that back together or else.
Welcome to Tech Talks, hosted by myself, David Savage, and powered by Nash Squared. So today's guest is Tia Hopkins. She is the Chief Cyber Resilience Officer and Field CTO at eSentire. And she is the first of two guests this week where we're observing Black History Month or African American History Month as we are celebrating in the US this month of February. And to help me do that, I'm thrilled that I'm joined by one of my colleagues, Kenya. How are you?
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, not too bad, not too bad. Look, I have to admit, I'm not exactly sure where you are in the US, where you're based. Whereabouts do you live?
I'm in Georgia. I actually, this is my second year of being here. I moved from New Jersey, the headquarters of Harvey Nash. So now I work remotely.
What was the reason for the move, if you don't mind me asking? Was it family or?
Yeah, family. Me and my husband moved down. So my family is still in New Jersey, actually.
I have to admit, I've not been to Georgia. I kind of know of Georgia, I guess, through music and culture, but that's about it. If you had to pick out a highlight for anyone in terms of the state, why they might want to visit, anything that kind of jumps out from your experience so far?
The Southern hospitality.
Yeah.
You can tell the people that are really from here, their hospitality is very warm and welcoming. Yeah. So it's different from being living in a northern state. You know, we're all, you know, when you're close to New York City, we're all everything is a hustle and bustle type of feel, you know, so it's quite laid back here. And the weather is awesome. Like, it's freezing in New Jersey now. And today I think it's going up to almost 67 degrees. So awesome.
Yeah, I'm looking out the window at grey skies and rain, which won't do any good for the British stereotypes around weather to any American listeners, or North American listeners. But having been to Tennessee, having been to Texas, I can imagine what you mean by Southern hospitality.
Yeah, very nice.
Well, look, we'll play today's interview with Tia, and we will come back with some commentary on it afterwards. So I'm lucky to be joined by Tia Hopkins. Tia, make sure I get this right, and this is where I get thrown astray by LinkedIn, but you are the Chief Cyber Resilience Officer and Field CTO at eSentire. Is that right? That's the right title?
That's right, yeah.
Look, thank you for taking the time. You're joining me from New York?
Yes, I am.
Am I right in thinking that you are a football fan in the American football sense?
Yeah, football fan and coach.
A big weekend given when we're recording.
Absolutely.
Do you have any particular preference on who wins the Super Bowl this weekend?
Oh, man, it's tough. My team's not there. The Dolphins are, you know, that's my team. But I think, you know, I want to see Mr. Purdy, Mr. Irrelevant, get a ring. I'd love to see that.
I have to confess, American football is not a sport I know a huge amount about, so yeah. I certainly won't get into a conversation any more detail than this. But I know it's a big weekend.
It is, absolutely.
And Usher is the halftime show, right? And Usher is absolutely my kind of age for when I was at university. So
yeah, I've always argued that the Monday after Super Bowl Sunday should be a U.S. holiday. I have no idea why it isn't.
Yeah, that makes sense. Anyway, that to one side. We're here to talk about technology. We're here to talk about cyber.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit more about the role with eSentire.
Sure. So as Chief Cyber Resilience Officer, I'm essentially responsible for our end-to-end strategy as it relates to bringing products and services to market that help our customers build more resilient cybersecurity programs. My current focus is on the exposure management element of our business. And then the field CTO portion of the role is really all around evangelism, having conversations with our customers, our partners, paying attention to market trends and things like that. And then leveraging, this is my favorite part of my job, leveraging the intersection of people, process, and technology to solve business problems.
And if you don't mind me asking, what was your route into technology? Because whether we like it or not, unfortunately, you know, when you look at demographics, women in tech are still very much in the minority.
Yeah.
Cyber, I suppose, it's probably even more so of a minority than technology overall, right?
Yep, absolutely.
How did you find yourself kind of getting interested in tech in the first place, in computing? Was it school? Was it in the home environment?
Yeah, it's kind of always been a thing for me. I've always been just very interested in, more interested in how things work versus actually using them for the intended purpose. Like, how did they get it to do this thing? So, you know, when I was growing up, my mom threatened to really stop buying me things because I would just take everything apart. So at 12, she bought me my first computer. And instead of getting on the internet, like most kids would do, I took it apart. She walked into my room and there was pieces everywhere. But I also built my first computer at 12 because it was, you will put that back together or else.
I have to say, so that frightens me. As someone who is inept and cannot build flat pack furniture, that frightens me slightly.
Yeah. But, you know, back then there was not a lot of guidance, especially, you know, my community. There's not a lot of people in tech to give me advice and things like that. And so, you know, when I graduated high school, somebody said, yeah, you're good with computers. You should do computers. And so I went to college for computer engineering. It was not a fit. And so I just kept trying and trying and trying. And what I learned over the years is that I've always been a technologist. So I like to solve problems with technology, not necessarily build a technology that solves the problems. And so I started my career as an internet installer, DSL installer for the phone company, moved into an IT role, and eventually decided to focus on cybersecurity. But it was a lot of self-learning, building labs at home, just trying new things, not being afraid to get things wrong. So a really non-linear path, but it's just kind of always been an interest of mine.
Just out of interest, to rewind a moment or two, you said about college not being a fit. Can I just delve into what you mean by that?
I dropped out of college 4 times.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I tried computer engineering. That dropout was because I realized I wasn't interested in engineering. I wasn't an engineer. A lot of calculus, a lot of physics. I was like, nah, I just want to get to the technology. Let's do the cool stuff. A few times after that, just bad timing. Lack of resources. But now I have 4 college degrees because I had to settle the score with myself. But back then I realized that part of the reason I was dropping out is because I didn't have a purpose other than it's what you're told you're supposed to do when you graduate high school.
Right.
But once I figured out what I wanted to do and what I was passionate about, it was, you know, to the moon.
Yeah, because, I mean, I was going to say, you look at your profile and quite clearly... You are very academic. You are very successful. You've written books. You kind of look and go, well, you dropped out 4 times. Like,
yeah.
Why? And obviously that point around purpose and it not being quite the right time, totally relevant. I imagine a huge amount of people can totally empathize with that. But at the same time, I imagine that there are people who drop out and then don't find a route back, and therefore the industry misses out on them. And I would imagine that, unfortunately, disproportionately, they are people probably from less privileged backgrounds. How do you think we can kind of fix that in education to stop people falling by the wayside, perhaps?
You know, I mean, I think it's a number of things. For one, I do think the education system as a whole could do a better job of, I'll say, workforce development. And this is actually why I got into teaching and decided to become a professor, is because when I went through to a couple of master's in information security, cybersecurity programs, it was a lot of theory. So you read the content and you write a paper on what you learn. But what I didn't feel like I was getting is an understanding about how to actually solve problems. So what you have is one. So on one side, I know I said there's a couple of answers here. On one side, you have people that can't even afford formal education, just not an option. So we need a way to enable those individuals to feel like there is still a path for them into industry. What does that path look like? And then those that do want to pursue the academic route, there needs to be more workforce development versus just academic education, because a lot of these individuals graduate with bachelor's and even master's degrees and get into an interview and they can recite theory, they can give you definitions and they can tell you what a firewall is and what it does, but they can't solve a business problem. So I think a shift to more workforce development versus just academic education is critically important.
You mentioned that you teach. You have a not-for-profit, right?
Yes.
What is that?
So my nonprofit is Empower Cybersecurity, mm-hmm. And it's focused on getting more women of color interested in and confident in their ability to have a successful cybersecurity career.
So you teach, you have a not-for-profit, and you have your day job, for want of a better phrase, yes. at East Entire. What you're doing for your community is fantastic in terms of trying to make sure that people are aware of the opportunities that there are for them.
Thank you.
What though is the responsibility or the, not necessarily to point at East Entire, but you work for them, but what could corporates do to try and help, you know, or because it shouldn't necessarily fall on the shoulders of individuals to go out of their way to do extraordinary extra as you have. What could corporates do to try and help that transition?
I think the lens I often look at this through is, you know, you turn on the news or you read articles, you listen to podcasts or leaders speak, mm-hmm. and there's this huge cybersecurity skills gap. Then on the other side of that, you have all of these newcomers to cybersecurity that can't find jobs. And I'm like, okay, well, what's going on here? And the reality is, and I get it, cybersecurity is high stakes. So you can't just say, hey, I'm going to do the right thing. I'm going to hire 10 people brand new to cybersecurity to run my security program, because if something happens to the business, you're going to have a bigger problem. But I do think, I think corporate could do a better job of making room for newcomers to industry, because we also have this problem where we're all fishing in the same pool for mid to senior level talent to run our programs, but they're also doing a lot of repetitive things and things that aren't like motivating for them and exciting to them that could be carved out and passed on to someone a bit more entry level. And you bring in someone entry level, then those mid to senior level individuals have the opportunity to mentor and coach, and it's, you know, stretch opportunities for them. So one, I think corporate needs to do a better job of making room for newcomers to industry. Once they make room for newcomers to industry, then that opens up the opportunity for us to get better about how we're crafting these job descriptions. Because in order for corporate to do that, they have to sort of restructure their programs, rethink the way they're looking at roles, responsibilities. And then that leads to, okay, what is the actual profile of this entry-level individual? That informs the job description. That trickles down to, you know, academia. Now they are better prepared to you know, groom these individuals to be ready for the workforce. And then the newcomers themselves have a better idea of what they need to do to be prepared for industry. Because right now it's like, hey, you should get into cybersecurity. It's great. You can make a lot of money. And these individuals show up and it's like, okay, there's 50 domains and 20 domains underneath those 50 domains. And then there's one job title that means 20 different things. And they're telling me to get all these certifications. Where do I go and what do I do?
You also mentioned about the fact that you're kind of empowering women of color within security, cybersecurity.
Yeah.
I am not going to fall into the trap of making any assumptions, but I am, you know, I'm white, cisgendered, pretty privileged British male. So I totally underqualified to make any guesses about what it's like to necessarily come from or talk to people from some of the communities that you do. When you're with that group of people, what tend to be the challenges that they're facing?
Being seen, number one, feeling like they have a voice, a sense of belonging. I firmly believe that then the term that I use is an arms race. And, you know, arms race usually applies to weaponry. But if we think about what modern warfare is going to look like, it's going to be hands on keyboard. And so the arms race is us diversifying the cybersecurity workforce so that we can compete with a diverse adversary. And the reason I bring up the whole arms acronym is because what underrepresented individuals need is they need awareness, representation, mentorship, and sponsorship and support. And so I think we're doing a better job of awareness. Mm-hmm. Representation isn't what I would like it to be. I still don't see a lot of people like me in boardrooms and, you know, at the C-suite table and in leadership. Mentorship is really important. You know, individuals need to feel like there is a place for them in this industry, because right now what they're seeing is especially women. It's a male-dominated industry. There's not a lot of people of color in industry. So if I want to be successful and I want to invest in my future, I want to invest in something that I feel pretty good about in terms of whether or not I can be successful. And so representation and mentorship really moves the needle in terms of them feeling like that's possible. But then we have the problem of when individuals get into industry, they don't feel like they fit into the culture, or they don't feel like they have an opportunity to grow. They're going to be in the role that they're in forever because they're not getting the support or sponsorship that they need to continue to move forward. So it is a lot of, individuals feel like they're being discriminated against. And sometimes that's true. And sometimes it's just a matter of they don't really know who to talk to get the answers mm-hmm. that they need to try to move their career forward. But there is a lot of, I would say, microaggressions that exist. Like I deal with it. I walk into a room and when I begin to present, it's almost a look of surprise on people's faces when I'm articulate and insightful and things like that. And it doesn't bother me anymore because I've been dealing with it for a long time. But those things do exist. And I imagine someone new to industry dealing with something like that is not, you know, it doesn't roll off, you know, the shoulders quite as easily.
Yeah. And it's interesting you talk about being seen. As you said there, you're working, you know, mentorship programs and so on. You're probably working with a lot of those individuals within your community to try and help them feel like they are being seen. But right. if there are people outside of your community that you feel, hang on, there we can be a catalyst for change, here we can influence this person and help them see these people, where do you feel you can make the most impact to try and slowly improve circumstances and improve the opportunities for people?
You know, that's a good question, because there's two sides to the coin, right? There's what the industry can be doing to make it better, and then there's what can individuals be doing to make sure they're better prepared. Because on the one hand, I could say, well, we need to create more opportunities and programs, and, you know, we need to do more around awareness, and we need to start with the kids and all these things. But on the other side of that, if the industry and corporate puts forth all these efforts, and then the people themselves aren't ready when the opportunities come about, then we've kind of created the opposite problem. So I do think there's work to be done on both sides. But I think, you know, it's kind of a hard question for me because there's so much that needs to be done. But the biggest problem is I think we just don't know what good looks like. You know, what is the profile of someone looking to get into this industry that maybe can't afford a college education or can't put out a lot of money for degrees? Is it building labs? Well, that's not the only answer, because there are non-technical roles in security. So I think a bit more definition around what it means to be a cybersecurity professional and the types of different roles you can get into. But the biggest gap I see, and I kind of got myself here as I was talking, the biggest gap I see is more of a focus on the person. And that's what my program does. When we take individuals through the program, what we do is we have them go through an exercise where they do a workforce DISC assessment, and then they go through what, I don't know if you're familiar with Ikigai, but it's basically an exercise that helps you define your purpose. Like, what am I good at? What does the world need? What can I get paid for? And these things come together to show you your purpose. So then you combine your personality style with your purpose, and then you start to look at what does that look like in terms of the type of roles that I might get into in cybersecurity? Because a lot of these folks get dumped in the industry and say, look at this job, that job, get this certification, that certification, without understanding what they as an individual can bring to industry. So I guess I said all that to say more of a focus on what are the skills that aren't hard skills, maybe personality traits and soft skills that individuals can even get started with.
Look, I was really keen to talk about some of those topics, because obviously February is Black History Month in the US, and it's a conversation that needs to be had. Putting that to one side for a moment and just treating it purely on technology terms, you work in cyber right now. There's a lot of challenges, there's a lot of emerging technologies, but what excites you? What kind of is the kernel of stuff that you're working on, where you kind of go to people who aren't in the industry? It's really cool. This is interesting work. This is why you should be in this sector.
I mean, I think the thing for me personally is I thrive in chaos, which I learned about myself over the years.
That's probably not a good message for the C-suite to know that's what it's like at the minute. But I get your point.
Yeah. I mean, listen, cybersecurity is like that, whether you're on the board in the C-suite, you know, all the way down to individual contributor. But I love that just like football, there's a place for everyone in this industry. You know, American football, you got 11 people on the field and there's a spot for the person that's, you know, 200-300 pounds and could lift a building out of the ground. And also the person that is 100 pounds soaking wet with a pocket full of rocks. Cybersecurity is the same way, whether you're uber technical or you're great at pattern recognition, or you're a great communicator, whatever it is, there is a place for everyone in industry. So that's the first thing that I love about it. But for me personally, I feel like I'm solving a different problem every day. And it's not good for business that just when you feel like you've got it figured out, attackers change tactics or there's some new thing you have to worry about, because it is stressful. But it's exciting, right? Because you can't ever get too comfortable. You have to always be learning and stay on your toes and try to stay one step ahead and think outside the box. And I like to say the first person's thought processes and core values that I challenge every day are my own. And the question I ask every day are is the solutions that I came up with yesterday, do they still solve today's problems, and will they still continue to solve the problems I think I'm going to have tomorrow? And that's how we have to think in this industry. And that's what I love about it. Just continuous learning, always being open. I like to say I have strong opinions, but loosely held. So prove me wrong, because things are changing all the time. Then there's always something for me to learn.
One last question then. If someone is interested in your book, what's the title? Where can they find it? Where can they get their hands on it?
Yeah, sure. So the book is Securing Our Future, Embracing the Resilience and Brilliance of Black Women in Cyber. And it can be found on Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
Well, look, thank you very much for your time. I was about to say this afternoon. It's this morning from your perspective. But
it is.
Thank you very much for your time today. And enjoy the weekend. And I hope that Monday isn't too much of a struggle for you.
Thank you. You have a good one as well.
Before we get into the debate, you just want to tell us a little bit about your background, Kenya. And obviously, you know, we've asked you to be the co-host on this show. You're part of our employee resource group internally. But tell us a little bit about yourself before we kind of get into a conversation.
As you know, my name's Kenya. I work for Harvey Nash, Inc. In the States. I've been with Harvey Nash since 2006, so I believe in May. I've been here for, 18 years. So I did my younger years with Harvey Nash. I work under the CFO, Ted Blumenberg, and my manager, the HR director, which is Lisa Kaiser. We actually all started around the same time. We built like a little family, you know. Most of the people that started in 2006 in the back office, the accounting office, we still work together. We watched our kids grow up. We watched our kids go to college. So we became a little close-knit family.
It's interesting. I mean, you trumped me by about a year. I joined Harvey Nash 17 years ago. in the UK, and obviously now work for Nash Squared, the group. And look, in that time, I've seen vast amounts of changes within our business here in the UK. You know, ERGs certainly weren't something that we had 17 years ago. The Diversity, Inclusion and Equality Council, I think, came into being probably about 4 or 5 years ago. With regards to Black History Month and its observance and kind of those instances being properly recognized, how much has the difference been, or have you noticed a tangible difference in the last couple of years to how the company was previously? And look, as I said, I've been here for 17 years. This is not me attacking necessarily the heritage of the organization that we've both been part of for a long time. But I personally think there's been some positive changes. But obviously, I work in London. It's a very long way from where you are. It's perhaps a slightly different business. You might say that maybe you were more progressed on some of these issues than we were.
I agree with you. Just the time span of being here, it's a big difference from when I first started to now. I can honestly say when I first started, we didn't have Martin Luther King Day off. You know, it wasn't a holiday for us. So if we did want to take it, we would have, you know, we use our own PTO, you know. As to now, you can see that we do have that off as a holiday. We even do have June, you know, another African American holiday off as well in June. So I've seen steps into the right direction as far as for acknowledging Black History Month and acknowledging the culture as a whole. I think it's more of an action now versus talk with Harvey Nash. Let's put it that way. Again, because they're getting more hands on versus to just talking about it. So it's a big difference from when I first started until now. Yes.
And so I suppose when Tia talks about being seen, that is probably something therefore that resonates.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Like I said, honestly, when I first started, I was the only African American. It wasn't a culture shock for me because of my upbringing. Where I grew up at, I am used to being one of the not so many in the room. So it was nothing different for me. But when I first started, I was the only African American. I can say that I didn't feel as an outcast. You know, mm-hmm. I give that. You know, I do know, like, just in general conversations, a lot of things probably was maybe like shocking to them of experiences that I had to have, you know, that I had during the years of being at Harvey Nash. Like I can remember one time I actually went on lunch and I got pulled over. And they were saying that the police officer said that he was pulling me over because he couldn't see my tag, my license, my tag on my car. And it was vividly there, you know. It was nothing that was blocking the view of the license plate or anything. And he held me for like a long time, you know, and he's, you know, like, and the questions I got was, what are you doing in this area? Like, why are you here? You know, and which wouldn't be a typical question for someone else, you know? I remember I called Lisa again, Lisa Kaiser, you know, the HR director. And I'm like, listen, the cops pulled me over. I don't know when I'm coming back from lunch. This is what's going on. But just in case, you know, like I gave her the officer's name, just in case something happens to me, this is what's going on with me right now. So just little things of that nature, you know, that I have experienced, you know, working there, and they have experienced it with me, you know, and it's sad. Like, she's apologetic, you know, when I got back to work, I'm so sorry this happened to you, you know, but again, it's not her fault. It's just the world that we live in, you know.
Obviously, not being ignorant to the news, you know, that stuff is going on,
right?
But it nonetheless makes it no less shocking when you hear that it is happening and someone just out on their lunch. Look, you obviously had the chance to listen to Tia's interview. What jumped out to you or resonated in particular?
She made a comment. First of all, I was really intrigued that she has a nonprofit for women of color for cybersecurity. I do see that. I don't think the percentage rate is high in that area for a woman of color. And that in itself is awesome that she's trying to change the narrative, I may say, in that area and bringing on newcomers. And I agree with her. She said that, you know, with doing that, it is making room for newcomers, you know. So I'm intrigued that she's opening up that spectrum to a diverse look. So that's something that really stuck out to me. And also what stuck out to me, at 12 years old, she got her first computer and she took it apart. Well, you know, like, she took a whole computer apart at 12 years old, you know, and put it back together. She rebuilt it. 12, you know, like, awesome mindset. Yeah,
and obviously was in the right environment, yet somehow education almost failed her, which speaks volumes about the need to tackle education.
Right. And to know she, you know, like she said, she dropped out 4 times before she even finished, you know, went back to get her degrees, and then, which is awesome because she got 4 degrees after the fact, you know, so her story is very uplifting, you know, it's encouraging.
Yeah. Kenya, thank you. And we will talk again.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Tech Talks is hosted and edited by David Savage. It is produced by Nash Squared. And we have special thanks to Lemzy for supplying music to this show.